standing by. At this time, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. During the question and answer session, please press star one on your touch-tone phone, and please record your name clearly when prompted. When recording your name, please make sure your phone is off mute. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections at this time, you may disconnect. And now I would like to turn the meeting over to your host, Mr. Sam Weber. Mr. Weber, you may begin, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to welcome everybody to the ninth in our monthly series of Watch Talks, which are currently being held every third Thursday, and in room 110 in the National Science Foundation, if you're able to come in person and televised. And just to start, I mean, when I was a young grad student, I remember someone coming up to me and saying, okay, all the old security folks are really grumpy because they've spent their entire life telling people how to make systems secure and have been absolutely ignored. You really want to go into this area. And it is true that there is this big gap between academia and practice, and it seems even greater in security than most other fields. But there are actually people who have managed to pass over that gap. And in our program, the Secure and Trustworthy Cyberspace program, we're now actually making a specific effort to do transitions to practice led by Kevin Thompson to try to help and assist academic work to make that transition to practice. And therefore, I'd like to introduce Paul Barford, who actually is a professor of computer science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and also was the founder and former CEO of Neiman Networks, which was a network security startup company, which was acquired by Qualys. Yes. And therefore is a lot of experience in taking academic work and put it out in the real world and getting results. Therefore, I'd like to turn it over to him.
Thank you, Sam. Well, it's a pleasure to be able to come and speak to this august group today. I'm going to pass along some thoughts and ideas that are not deeply technical in nature, but hopefully a little bit challenging, and also that inspire a conversation about how we might better facilitate transition of technology in the security domain from research into actual practice. So feel free to interrupt in, I think it's okay, is that right, in from the local audience, but I guess the telephone audience might have to wait until the end. So please jump right in. So let me start out by offering a little bit of a history of the threat space, something that I think everybody is probably familiar with at some level. You may or may not know that the fossil record shows that roughly 500 million years ago, most of the phyla that actually exist on Earth today suddenly came into existence. And I think we're going to see something similar in the security domain, that in this time of the early 2000s, that most of the basic threats that we're actually experiencing in the Internet today have come into existence. And while there will, of course, continue to be lots of innovation in terms of how threats actually are imposed on systems and capabilities in the Internet, I think that you can boil things down into a basic set of models that we have today. So if you look back historically, most people point to the Morris worm in the late 80s as sort of being the first major instance of a Internet-wide attack. Then we had this kind of strange quiescent period in the 1990s where, yes, there were viruses, but nothing too major, and we all kind of felt good about the Internet. And then all of a sudden, in 2001, we had this real explosion of the malicious activity, starting with the Code Red worm, and there's been a gigantic escalation since then. A long series of worms, of phishing activity. We had then bots really start to come to the fore in about the 2004 timeframe, and now we have these super bots out there that are really causing a lot of problems. I would characterize today's environment as one in which we're seeing evolving cyber ecosystems. The folks at Berkeley and San Diego did some really interesting work that was published in Usenix Security last year on the pay-per-install activity that's going on, which is just fascinating when you think about the fact that there's a recognition of different strengths and capabilities of different individuals, whether it's to compromise systems or to actually place capabilities on systems to garner intellectual property or financial gain. And to recognize that separation and then to create an infrastructure to leverage that separation in terms of pay-per-install was really insightful and really interesting, and I think we're going to see more of that as time goes by. So the point is that what this highlights is the fact that the threat landscape and the corresponding security domain are highly complex, diverse, dynamic, and are going to continue to change over time. But because of the fact that we have really what I would say is a 5 to 7 year difference between what's going on in the threat domain and what's going on in the security domain, meaning that defenders are 5 to 7 years behind the people who are actually out there conducting malicious activity in the Internet, the only way that we're going to make gains, I would contend, is through innovation. In other words, step function increments in capability to defend against attacks versus incremental capabilities, which we're really seeing coming out of industry today. Okay? So to sort of further those thoughts, the way that I characterize the security activities in the Internet today is that we're winning battles, but we're really losing the war, and unfortunately, the black hats are quite a ways out in front of us. So the defenders of Internet infrastructure typically or often think about this notion of defense in depth, and we have capabilities that offer a certain measure of security. We have perimeter defenses. We have host defenses. We are paying more attention to physical security of infrastructures. We have some nice crypto capability. I think people are paying more attention to strong passwords and the more ubiquitous use of encryption. We are also recognizing that policies, procedures, and education play an important role in defending our infrastructures. And I will also concede, I guess, at some level, that best practices do, in fact, provide a measure of security, right? We don't hear mention of script kiddies that often anymore, okay? So really what we're looking at is a raising of the bar, right, in terms of best practices. But the problem is that the sophistication and capabilities of attackers continues to evolve, and the most insidious malicious actors continue to act with impunity. Sadly, these people are really moving up the food chain in terms of the targets for their efforts. Right. There's been a great deal or a large number of reports of the financial and data-related cybercrime. Much of this, of course, I'm sure you know, is coming from state actors. So there is a recent report of a group that is called from folks in the U.S., this Byzantine Foothold Group out of China, that have compromised data and financial information from over 760 companies over the last 10 years. Well, that is just, you know, a really a staggering number for one group of actors to have accomplished. We have really game changers when you look at Stuxnet and Dooku. We can't think for a minute that just because those pieces of code were possibly developed by state actors, that private actors aren't going to pick up on the capabilities and techniques of those tools. Probably some of you have read the forensic analysis that have been published in places like Wired. I found those fascinating. But nevertheless, the point is that these tools are insidious. They're highly capable. They're expertly designed and developed. And they represent a threat that I think we all have to be very concerned with as a possible model for what we're going to be facing at a broad scale over the foreseeable future. What they also point to very directly is the fact that while we have been predicting attacks on infrastructure, of course, Stuxnet is the canonical example of a piece of malicious software that targets infrastructure. Even though it targeted in a very focused way Siemens centrifuges in Iran and was not used, as far as we know, broadly beyond that. Dooku is something that has a broader focus, even though reports of its use are limited to attacks in Iran and the Sudan, at least as far as the literature that I've read. It is an amazing piece of software and something that is based on Stuxnet, but also has new and enhanced capabilities. So when we talk about infrastructure, what a lot of us are really concerned about, of course, are the control systems, the SCADA systems that are used to operate machinery, manufacturing, the power grid, and other major infrastructures. There was a report that appeared in Wired recently about a private group that did a broad analysis of five different major SCADA systems to, providers over an extended period of time, looking for vulnerabilities in those systems. Perhaps some of you have seen this report. It was actually presented at the S4 conference prior to it appearing in Wired. And the news is very bad. In fact, most of the PLCs that are available from major vendors today not only have identified vulnerabilities, but this group has further developed exploits for those vulnerabilities that are now available in Metasploit. So it doesn't take very much imagination to come to the conclusion that people are going to begin to use what Metasploit, okay, an openly available piece of freeware, to potentially target SCADA systems. And that is what is was represented on the last slide with respect to the water systems in Springfield, Illinois. So the point is that this group looked at these PLCs quite broadly, and the news is not good. And unfortunately, some of the responses in this article from Wired from the vendors are basically saying, we don't have the ability to actually include security on some of these systems because they're old. So what are we going to do? Well, that's a great question. Well, let me take things even down a little bit further, make things even a little bit more negative, which is to take a really kind of cynical view of the whole environment here, which is, if you're a company that provides security solutions, you want bad things to happen. You're very happy when new bad things happen because it gives you a broader way to potentially bring value to your customers. And to that end, why would you ever really want these things to go away? You don't really want to solve security problems. Again, this is my totally cynical view, okay? This is not the way things are necessarily in reality at all. You want to sort of solve them, okay, to continue to be very relevant and to add value broadly. I would ask on the heels of that, we hear about the bad things that are going on all the time. What are the big security success stories? In other words, do we have major successes where we say we have entirely shut down this avenue of attack and it will never happen again? I don't know of these. Actually, I think that the best security success stories that I've heard of recently are actually these forensic activities to decompose some of the more insidious threats that we've seen recently, and some of the things coming out of the research community in terms of digging into, for example, the pay per install or some of the value chain issues that people have looked at recently. Further cynicism on my part. There has been this amazing kind of explosion in government contractors, all of the sort of usual suspects having large security groups. I have not really seen research publications from these groups. I've not interacted with these groups in, let's say, in the early 2000s. Why are they all suddenly having a big presence in security? Well, I think the answer is pretty obvious, because there's money to be made there through normal government channels, which tend to be very complex, very hard to figure out, but these guys have really dialed in. And, of course, the danger there is that, in fact, best practices, new research, and the innovative ideas are not going to be brought to the fore because these companies are ill-equipped to actually bring that technology into the mainstream. So I'm going to present a series of challenges here which build from this sort of somewhat dire state of affairs that I've just presented over the last several slides. And the first challenge is this issue of technology versus innovation. And I pose the simple question in the security context, what is the next big thing? And from a threat perspective, well, I can think of a lot of things, right? I think we all can. And most of them are kind of scary, right? They're large-scale events that make us frightened as opposed to small-scale events where, you know, it's somebody else or some, you know, overseas financial institution which doesn't have anything to do with me. It's the large-scale events which are really quite frightening right now. But from the other side, from the defender side of things, and something that NSF has been a big supporter of, I think that the real countermeasure opportunities are in very different ways of doing things, right? Not pursuing simple augmentation and incremental improvement in standard best practices. It's actually changing the playing field through new security architectures that offer us the best opportunity to address the spectrum of threats that we're faced with today and in the future. So the question then is, though, if new architectures are sort of one possibility, where will that next big thing come from in terms of, you know, what group is going to develop it? And what I would submit is that companies in general and security companies in particular are good at developing new technology. Okay, they have something, some tool, some infrastructure, some capability, some service that they've already developed, and they're very good at making an incremental improvement on that potentially to address some broader set of threats. All right, we don't really entirely know what's going on in the GovMil space because there's this sort of tendency to immediately classify something as soon as it might possibly be something of interest. So what I would say is that entrepreneurs are the true innovators and the people where we can have high hopes that we might come up with the next big thing, the solutions that are really going to provide these step function improvements in security. Well, let me not limit my finger pointing. I'll point some fingers at academia, too, which is the, of course, beneficiary of a lot of the research funding that comes from NSF. And what I would say is that in my experiences, many of the processes in academia actually stifle innovation. We have this tenure conundrum, which I've talked about with many people here at NSF, which is that you have to get as many papers published as possible. You have to get a career award. You have to get funding from NSF and other important agencies in order to get tenure. And what I would say is that all of these incentives are not oriented necessarily around innovation and definitely not oriented around technology transfer. Well, that's unfortunate, okay? There is, I think, a recognition at some point that true innovation often happens when people are young. And if we impose these set of processes at universities that, in fact, drive people away from innovation, then that's a real disservice to the broader community, which I think we're all really interested in having a positive impact on. I would also add that, unfortunately, at many institutions, and I'll single out Wisconsin as an example, we do have a rather unenlightened IP management process, intellectual property management process. A lot of this is heightened by the fact that we're in a time of tight budgets, and intellectual property and patents are seen as a potential stream of revenue, so we must monetize those as quickly as possible, right? And we have to patent everything that comes along because there is then ultimately the possibility of driving revenue. But the problem is that sometimes patenting something and sometimes trying to license something on a non-exclusive basis is not the way to actually introduce technology into the mainstream. And ultimately, our goal is to move innovation into the mainstream, especially in the security domain, in a way that enables it to have the broadest possible impact. So one possible direction that I think people have been paying a lot more attention to recently is this direction of trying to foster companies, right? Trying to actually incubate companies within universities. And we have
that activity going on within University of Wisconsin right now. We have a program whereby professors can make proposals and get a little bit of money to start a company. Well, as I was discussing with some colleagues earlier today, I would submit that professors are not the best target for incubation. There are some people who are very successful entrepreneurs who come out of academia, no question about it, and they've done great, and we know who they are, and, you know, we can go down a rather short list of them. But in general, professors are very concerned with their research program, very concerned with their students, very concerned with their teaching, very concerned with their service. And when you have that many activities on your plate, you don't have the ability to throw yourself into a company on a 24/7 basis for a period of a couple years, which is what it takes to get a good company off the ground. So perhaps some of our incubation efforts, at least from universities, are a little unfocused right now, and maybe there are ways to refocus those to be more successful in the future. Finally, let me say that why aren't we teaching entrepreneurship in computer science? At University of Wisconsin, we teach entrepreneurship in the business school. But if you look at the major success stories, at least from the perspective of technology over the last 10 years, you look at companies like Google. You look at companies like Facebook. Facebook can be argued as being the most important development in the last 10 years, right? 500 million users log into Facebook every day. It is a new modality for communication that we've never seen before. Zuck wasn't in a business school, right? He was a computer science school a student. Maybe we need to embrace entrepreneurship as an element of computer science going forward. I put this slide in the deck because it's something that on my sabbatical last year I took some time thinking about, which is very related to all of the incentives in academia, which are where we publish papers. And I took some time going through the Sightseer archive. Maybe some of you are familiar with that. It tracks computer science publications. And you can quibble about the comprehensiveness of Sightseer versus Google Scholar versus Microsoft Academics versus whatever index of papers you happen to look at. But the nice thing about Sightseer is that they do provide a top 100 most cited papers on an annual basis. And I took a selection of the top three conferences, arguably, in security versus the arguably top conference in networking. And I plotted the instances of occurrence in the top 100 most cited over a period of 15 years. And what you can see from this graph is that BigCom has a very prominent role, right? A lot of top 100 cited papers over a period of about 10 years, kind of fallen off in the last couple of years. Not quite sure why that's there. I have some conjectures about that. But one of the nice things that you see is that there is an upswing in innovation from the security conferences, probably on the heels of all of that growth of malicious activity that we've seen starting around about the 2001 time frame with the big worm outbreaks. So the point is that there are good ideas that are capturing the computer science community, at least at some level in security. And now what our task is to see if we can bridge that gap between the development of these ideas and the actual deployment into practice. So how do we do that? Well, starting companies is fraught with difficulty. And I'm sure that I'm preaching to the crowd at some level in terms of this. But having gone through it in my company, Nemean Networks, which I founded in 2007 and transitioned to Qualys in 2010, I can tell you that that gap in hindsight is way, way bigger than it is when you're standing in front of it to begin with. Looks like it's a short jump when you first get the company started. No problem. We're going to start revenue streams. We're going to start getting customers. We're going to start being profitable, you know, in the next 2 or 3 years. And then once you've crossed the gap and you look back, you can say, oh, my God, I can't believe I thought I was going to get over that. So the point is that there are standard issues when starting any company that face network security startups. But then there are additional issues which really complicate the process. So one is the fact that there are, of course, huge concerns with privacy when it comes to actual deployments in companies. So a standard first step for a young company is to look very carefully for a company that's willing to deploy your technology as a prototype deployment. But depending on the product that you're actually bringing to them, that can be hugely, hugely fraught with difficulty, right? What traffic are you going to actually – you're not going to look at our live traffic, are you? Well, it's those kinds of questions and those kinds of issues which really complicate this process of bringing a company into a revenue-positive state. Another confounding issue is that there are many complexities with respect to regulations and especially governmental processes if you ever want to deploy your capabilities in governmental networks. I will not forget a conversation that I had with Farnam Jahanian when my company was very early, when I had just finished making a presentation to the NSA. And I called Farnam and said, they had a positive response. Do you think I should continue to pursue this? He said, absolutely not. He said, you will encounter huge difficulties when it comes to actually getting your system deployed in those networks, getting any information back from them about how it's working, and effectively operating your system in the way that you want it to operate. If you want to throw it over the wall to them, if they want to take it, then, maybe that's something you could consider, but don't look at it as a revenue stream anytime soon. Okay? So, and of course, lastly, we're in a very fickle community when it comes to things that are hot, right? The targets move all the time. Something's in, something's important, and 2 years later, it's not important. So there's no solving this last bullet point. It's just something that we have to recognize that the bootstrapping process in the security domain really can't take a long time, because if you go to a conference like RSA, year after year, you can see that the buzzwords change very frequently, and if you're doing something that's considered passé, then it's really not deemed important anymore, even though it might be important, and it makes the sales process and the transfer process much more difficult. Okay, so this is going to be motherhood and apple pie to this audience. There are always challenges with resources. And I spent some time trying to come up with an actual number for the annual investment in cybersecurity research, basic cybersecurity research from the U.S. government on an annual basis. And in the end, I gave up because it's just too – there are too many sort of avenues and ways that this number can consider. So I just used the word tiny. And I'm not exactly sure, maybe somebody in the audience actually knows what that number is on an annual basis, but the fact is if you just look at NSF's budget or you look at DARPA's budget or you look at any other standard funding agency for cybersecurity research investment, and then you try to sort of parcel out what percentage that basic security research might be in that, you can see that in the end, just given the raw numbers, that the total investment must be small. But if we're thinking about threats that have the possibility of having an impact on the country, and remember, the president mentioned cybersecurity in his recent State of the Union address, then why are we investing such a small amount of money in basic research on something that's that big a threat? There should be a corresponding recognition, especially if you believe my arguments, that innovation are the way in which these threats are going to be addressed. There needs to be a much larger investment in basic research. And again, I'm sure that I'm not going to get a lot of pushback there. Another piece of good news is that we have strong advocates. I'm very bullish on the advocates that we have in National Science Foundation, in Homeland Security, in DARPA, and so forth. The cybersecurity bell is being rung by many of those people, and I'm confident that we will see an uptick in funding for basic research over time. But I will say, and I think we all know and respect Doug Maughan's leadership in this space, it's been a long time coming. So hopefully the fruits of those efforts will be able to be harvested in the not-too-distant future. But one thing I will say when it comes to basic research is that it's not just about writing papers. It really is about putting technology into practice. Okay, so it's nice to write a paper, but to actually develop an algorithm or a technique or a capability into something that can be broadly deployed and scaled, that takes a lot of extra effort. Not a little bit of extra effort, a lot of extra effort. And what I wonder from an NSF perspective is whether or not we need to put a little bit more emphasis on that. And I understand that there is this tension between intellectual merit and broader impacts. I get that, okay? But maybe we can do things like, I don't know, linking the ability to, let's say, fast-track an STTR or SBIR award based on an existing award. I don't know. I think that you guys have probably talked about this problem a lot, and I look forward to engaging in that conversation as well because I think it's an incredibly important conversation. Well, let's consider the issue of resources from the industry perspective. So this is a graph that I copied without permission from the Wall Street Journal that lists the total amount of venture funds raised and allocated over the last several years. And the news is not good, right? So remember, this is all venture funding. This is not just funding in IT security, cybersecurity, which, by the way, makes up a relatively small component. If you go to the top-tier venture firms, the Sequoias and Kleiners and Excels of the world, and you look at the list of technologies that they're most interested in, what you're going to see is you're going to see the word green. Green shows up a lot. You're going to see the word social. Social is very popular these days. What you're not going to see a lot of is security, okay? So what you should do, again, is sort of back out what percentage of venture funds are going into cybersecurity startups from this community. And, again, don't know the exact number, but I'm going to say it's tiny, all right? So we have these big problems. Government has this tiny investment. Private industry has a tiny investment. We need innovation in order to get past these problems. Where is it going to come from? Well, one possibility is that we really are seeing a shift in the private funding model. Maybe some of you have heard of the company Y Combinator. Y Combinator is an interesting venture, spun up in Boston in around about 2005. By a couple of people who had just successfully spun out their company to Yahoo. And what they said is, hey, you know, we like hanging out around universities, and we want to foster innovation. You know, maybe we'll be venture capitalists. And they really landed on a cool model. And their model is that if you have an idea, you can make a proposal to Y Combinator, and if they like your idea, they will incubate you in an interesting way. They will give you about $20,000, $25,000. You can read their website. They take a small percentage of your company. But importantly, they will give you hands-on guidance to move your piece of software, they're purely software-oriented, to a prototype demonstrable form so that you can take the next step and hopefully get funding for the company and grow it. And these guys have been wildly successful. Look at the companies on their website that they list that they have incubated to at least an A round of funding. So I love this incubation idea. This is springing up everywhere. If you just do type in incubator into Google, you're going to find hundreds of these companies that are Y Combinator clones everywhere. But this is great. I think that this is really important. And what it recognizes is that there has been a shift in the funding model. We are no longer in a situation where we follow the traditional A round, B round, C round, mezzanine round, and then exit, right? We're in a situation where we have a lot of money in the angel domain and an increasing amount of money to incubate, much less money for A round funding. But once you get past typically considered success in early days, meaning that you're, you know, have a nice revenue growth stream, and have the a situation in which you need a larger amount of money, let's say $5 to $8 million to really scale your company, well, there's money in that area as well. So we've seen this shrinkage in traditional A round, growth in incubation and angel, and still money to roll out companies down the line. And I think Y Combinator is a great example of what can be done in terms of incubation. And I've just learned about this great new incubation program that NSF is spinning up. I think it's wonderful, and I think it'll be wildly successful, assuming that you have the right amount of mentorship in the process. So I think this is about my last challenge. I think we all need to recognize that there is a huge amount of competition out there. And the competition really is coming in my mind from a couple of different places. Number one, India and China, of course, are very focused on growing their research capability, right? Starting new universities, keeping their best and brightest at home. Good for them. But what we have to do is we have to react to that, right? We can't count on getting all of the top IIT students in our universities in the future. We have to do things that keep our talent at home and, foster our own talent at home so that we can track the best people into research, at least those people who have a penchant for doing that kind of work. I think we also have to recognize that domestic talent has lots of options. And I will highlight what I think of as a real dramatic shift in hiring that Facebook has undertaken. This was actually slashdotted about 3 or 4 months ago. I can give you the link to that if you like. But Facebook is coming to campuses. They have a target set of 20 campuses. They're holding hackathons on campus, which are just programming contests that they run for undergrads typically. The programming contest runs all night long, and for the winners, they get fun prizes, and it's generally seen as an image-building activity on campus. But what's happened recently is that the people who run these hackathons have the authority and the ability, if they identify people who are outstanding, to make them job offers on the spot. And the nature of the job offers are dramatic. Much different than anything that we've ever seen in the past. Salaries are incredibly high, starting at six figures. Okay? Huge bonuses. If students have companies, they will buy the companies on the spot. Okay? What's most dramatic about these offers is that they do not require the students to finish their degree. They offer them the ability to come and start working and actually encourage them to come and start working immediately if they want to. Okay? I don't blame Facebook one bit for this. They recognize that attracting the top talent and the top creative talent is the lifeblood of that company, and the way that they're going to continue to be competitive and have new offerings and new innovation down the road. They're doing the right thing for them, okay? And I think what we have to do as the academic community needs to offer students options so that I don't have to counsel these students to say, yeah, you know what, you should take that offer. You should go work for them right now. That's a great thing for you to do. And, I mean, this is not making this up. I mean, we actually had a counseling exercise, my colleague and I, this fall with a student who has made this offer, twice as much as his dad ever made, right? Hard to counsel a student not to take that offer, and we didn't. Ah, yes. Another challenge, one that will resonate, of course, with people who operate in the security domain, which is that when it comes to producing a new technology, there have to be means for actually assessing that technology in an objective fashion. Unfortunately, in security, we don't have an analog for flops or bits per second, right? Security is good when nothing happens. We all feel good about that, but that's not a good message, right? The number zero is typically not seen as being something that's positive. Wait, zero things happened? Nothing happened? Can't be negative, can it? No. It's either zero or bad. We need better metrics. And this is something that a friend of mine, Roy Maxion at CMU, has harped on for years and years. And the fact is that this is a very hard question, but maybe it's not the right question. right? Maybe we need to change the conversation. Maybe we need to orient this conversation around being proactive, right? What you can do in your infrastructure to make it more secure, right? Maybe we need to orient the conversation about adding robustness so that if things do fail, robustness takes over and we can continue to operate, all right? And then, of course, there is this ongoing, very attractive notion of somehow linking security as a, to products as a value add for products. I don't know how to do that, but if we can do that, then maybe that's a metric that's meaningful and that will resonate in the commercial domain. This is a big problem, though. Yeah, I already mentioned this issue of deployment. So imagine my surprise when I was talking to a major bank about my technology, an intrusion detection, new intrusion detection company. And I naively thought, well, if you want, they indicated they wanted to test our technology, and I thought, well, they would deploy it in their network, which is what you do with an intrusion detection system, right? And then when I said, well, you know, how can we we'll help you deploy it in your network, they said, well, we would never deploy it in our network. What, are you kidding? That's where our, you know, that's where our actual money is made. You can't just deploy something in a network. And I'm not making that up. So while the security people were extremely enthusiastic about our product, the decision makers in the company were the people who made money, okay? And under no circumstance were we going to be allowed to actually deploy an unproven, brand-new product, a prototype product, into an operational network to test it. And sadly, that's where that conversation just kind of ended. That bank had problems subsequent to that in 2008, so maybe that this was sort of an institutional issue and not just an issue with our product. But the point is that deployment of security systems, when it comes to this issue of technology transfer, is non-trivial. Okay? It's very easy to give someone data. If your value proposition is about data, and I'll come to this in another slide or two, then that's something that is very easy for people. Oh, you want to give us intelligence. We'll consume something. That's fine. But when it comes to actually deploying something in a security infrastructure in a live way, this can't be underestimated, and this is a significant challenge. Yes, my last, this is not a challenge, I call it a chalitunity. So most security research has been focused on defense, right, and really driven by threats and threat models. And what this has led to is an infrastructure that has robust capabilities but is, of course, very, very fragile, right? If there's a new threat, something that the infrastructure wasn't designed for, then it immediately breaks. And that's not the kind of infrastructure we want. So there is this possibility of the other side of the playing field, which is the offensive side of the playing field, right? Attackers always have the advantage. They only have to find one entry point into an infrastructure. Defense has to cover all possible entry points. It's an inherently unbalanced situation. It's just like sports. How often do you see 0-0 ties? Well, you don't, right? Offense always is able to score at some point on defense. Furthermore, in our situation, right, we always have humans in the loop. So even if the infrastructure is perfect, humans are not perfect, right? So we always have that entry point into an infrastructure. Well, it's pretty clear that offense in this cybersecurity domain can have an impact, and in fact, you're probably aware that in December of last year, Congress actually authorized offensive military operations in cyberspace. That's a big deal. It's on the congressional record. So the question is, how does the research community react to that? Now, I'm pretty sure NSF has regulations against these kinds of proposals, right? If I came in and said, I'm going to develop the next Stuxnet++, that would not be embraced, let's say, in the cyber technology directorate or cybersecurity technology directorate. However, this is it's been authorized by Congress. So how do we bring technology to bear in that area in a way that can have an impact in this domain, but one which satisfies the regulations and constraints of NSF and other agencies? And the answer is, I don't know, but this is a conversation that I think we need to have. So now we'll get more positive. I think there are lots and lots of opportunities and ways in which we can facilitate the transition of cybersecurity technology. The one, which is directly a direct result of sort of this deployment conundrum, is that there are opportunities to have an impact in terms of data, right? And I will offer a couple examples of those aggregates and signatures. What I mean by aggregates is actually putting together intelligence from disparate sources that give people the opportunity to orient their security infrastructure in a way that minimizes attack surface. Okay, so a great example of this are the data services on attacks that are offered by Symantec and other security companies for different vertical domains, right? So what are my competitors seeing in terms of attacks? They gather that information for verticals, and they produce it in a report, and these are very popular in the IT security operations domain. Obviously, signatures. I know we don't like signatures, but signatures are reality, right? For deployed IT security infrastructure, when it comes to antivirus or it comes to in-network defenses, having updated and tuned signatures are the key to stopping the majority of threats. Okay, so maybe that's a success story that that we can point to if we can do it in a way that we can demonstrate, again, reduces attack surface to a minimal standpoint. We have all of these opportunities in clouds now, right? We have software, storage, security as a service. And there are a lot of reasons to be positive about the opportunities and capabilities that clouds give us, right? Simplifies deployment, sort of lowers costs. I don't know whether anybody's actually worked with S3 or EC2, but it can actually be pretty darn expensive. But anyway, they want to sell you value on lowering costs, and at some level maybe it does from an operations perspective. But the point is it does change the playing field, and we should potentially, I think we need to embrace this and think about it in terms of what might be offered in terms of a broader set of security services going forward that are coming from the cloud and that are also offered within the cloud. Because remember, it's a totally controlled environment in the cloud, right? Well, this is somewhat motherhood and apple pie, another opportunity, secure software. Probably most of you are familiar with the fact that on the heels of the worm outbreaks, Bill Gates wrote a trustworthy computing memo to the entire Microsoft Corporation, which really highlighted the need for software assurance. And I'm totally in agreement there. And I think that there are indeed continued opportunities to develop tools and capabilities, and we have seen a growth in commercial offerings of tools and capabilities to make software more secure. Of course, the difficulty is that software is incredibly complex, and you always have humans in the loop, but starting with programming languages and moving into software development and software engineering techniques can lead to software that is inherently less vulnerable than what we've seen in the past, right? So it's not just development methods and languages that we need, but we also need to recognize the entire development process and to pay attention to where and how bugs are introduced and how they might be ferreted out and addressed. An additional opportunity is to more broadly educate on issues related to cybersecurity. And I'll point out three constituencies that I think will benefit greatly. First of all, consumers. These are private users, developers, and industry entities that can, I think, benefit very importantly from understanding how and when to recognize where threats might be introduced and how they can take advantage of certain simple ideas that will ultimately improve the security of network infrastructure. Another important constituency are the policymakers. There was the 2003 White House memo on a strategy for national cybersecurity, which is a very nice memo. Maybe some of you have read it. and there has been a growth in those kinds of documents over the last several years. The point is that policymakers, especially now that we've actually had presidential recognition, are going to become more involved in cyber policies. And we need to educate them often and with details on so that these policies can be formulated in a way that actually can have an impact. Okay. And then finally, of course, the next generation innovators not only need to be educated on how they might create technology to enhance security, but also how they can develop systems that don't have anything to do with security that are inherently more secure. So to that end, we have a new activity which I'm excited about at the University of Wisconsin, which we call the Wisconsin Innovation in Software Center. Kind of a play on our abbreviated name for the state, cute. And the whole idea here is to recognize two things. One is that students are not typically trained in computer science programs with the skills that actually enable them to build internet deployable software. We're very good at teaching standard topics, right? Simple programming languages, compilers, systems, databases, theory, algorithms, networking, you name it. We're very good at teaching those things. But most of the time, students have to go through training once they exit our programs in order to actually create software. So the first component of the center seeks to actually provide students with the training to actually develop deployable, internet-deployable software and to couple that with an entrepreneurial experience, to teach them about what it takes to start companies and to give them the perspective and infuse them with enthusiasm about actually creating a company, right? So how do you do that? How do you build a piece of software that can be deployed, that's scalable, that's robust, and that's extensible, right, to actually get users to start using it? The second component of this center recognizes that, hey, we could have the next Zook at University of Wisconsin. So what we should do is we should not let that value go to Y Combinator or go to Silicon Valley immediately, but we should foster that through an incubation process on campus, leveraging our incredible alumni and other partners to move that product into a demonstrable prototype, much in the way that Y Combinator does. So this will be a private entity that will operate very much in the way that other incubators operate, but leverages the students and the innovation that's happening on campus all the time. So we have this wonderful idea, the Wisconsin idea, that was articulated in 1916 by the University of President Charles Van Hise, which is the idea that the boundaries of the university extend to the boundaries of the state. It's a term that we use frequently at University of Wisconsin. It's been parroted by other universities. It means that we should have an impact beyond our campus. And we think that this kind of a center, which has the opportunity to start companies and create jobs, have an economic impact on our state, is an embodiment of this idea in the 21st century. So partnerships, the idea of partnerships are bandied around a lot, right? Public-private partnerships. And I agree that those have the real opportunity for success. But what I would say is that if you look at the call for partnerships in the cybersecurity policy statements from the early 2000s, what you'll see is that they maybe haven't had quite the impact on things that we'd like. And I think that this is because we have some lack of alignment on go-forward strategies between the government and between some of the private entities. And what this means is that we need to more broadly engage, I believe, with academia as a trusted third party to perhaps give a perspective that isn't currently there in some of these conversations. And even though I'll mention it in a later slide, I'll tell you the story right now. I participated in a meeting at NATO about a year ago, early 2011, on the heels of the NATO summit that was held in the fall of 2010, where cybersecurity was identified as NATO's number two responsibility, number two objective, right behind missile defenses. And I sat with the Supreme Commander, James Stavridis, very articulate guy, very, very impressive guy, and an assistant Secretary of Defense. And Stavridis just said, guys, I was the only academic there. Thank God I wore a tie. I did have jeans on, but at least I decided to wear a tie that day. And he said, we don't know how to do this. We need your help. Okay, Supreme Commander of NATO saying that to a group of private companies and one academic. And what I would say is that was a very interesting conversation that unfortunately hasn't gone anywhere. So maybe it's because I don't have a contract number that I can begin billing to. I don't know. All right, so I'm almost done with my talk, and I know I'm almost out of time. To facilitate the technology transition, I think we've built some very good infrastructure, which I'll point out here at the bottom in terms of the DHS Deter and Predict projects and the Genie project that give us the ability to do basic testing of cybersecurity capability. But we really need to escalate that. We need much more capability to routinely, robustly, and in a metrics-based way, assess new and innovative technologies so that you don't have the problems that I faced where I only could point to my deployment at the University of Wisconsin and say, here's how my system did versus SourceFire and versus a couple other systems in this one deployment. We need the ability to actually test new systems, new tools, new algorithms and capabilities so that the world can see, hey, there's the Underwriters Labs version for cybersecurity. And this is really what I'm appealing to here. I think we have basic infrastructure and basic capability in place, and now what we need to do is take that to the next level so that we can truly assess and evaluate new technologies. I mentioned policy a little bit earlier. This is basically saying this slide is all about the idea that policy is going to become more prevalent in the conversation, and we need to play a prominent role in educating the community about what technologies are, where the pitfalls are, and how we can form policy that that actually has the opportunity to have an impact. I will point to a very interesting workshop that took place that was organized by Fred Schneider last year. Probably some of you were familiar with that. This is all oriented around training academics to participate in scientific policy. Totally cool exercise. I also participated in an activity, a meeting at with Senate Foreign Relations Committee staffers that was organized by the Tobin Group, which is a policy group based in Boston. People are eager for cybersecurity policy, and I think we as a community really haven't had much discussion about how we might inform and guide that conversation. All right, second to last slide. The real opportunities are in innovation. This is the whole theme of my talk, is that we have to foster innovation. And I just offer a couple of ideas. So number one, whenever you talk to anybody in cyber operations about situational awareness, they would say, I would love to have that. Anything that you can give me to enhance situational awareness would be great. Okay. Unfortunately, there aren't that many tools. There isn't that much capability to provide situational awareness. Secondly, I think we have to recognize that cloud mobile is here. So developing capabilities to provide solutions in the cloud mobile environment are going to be eagerly embraced if we can do that. I decided to put something controversial on here, which is regulation and enforcement. But again, I think we have to recognize that, for example, the FBI is very, very focused on cybersecurity right now. And it's important for us as a community to understand what their needs are and to see if some of the technologies that we're developing actually can play a role in enhancing their activities. Okay, so in conclusion, right on my hour almost, if I looked at where we started, we have a really scary threat landscape right now, today and going forward, and I believe that the only way that we're going to effectively address these threats is through innovation, not through incremental change. We have a huge number of challenges that we have to face in terms of bridging the gap between basic research and actual deployment. And I've offered a couple of suggestions on how we might begin to bridge this gap. But I'm very positive, actually, about this space. I think we have a huge number of opportunities to have impact. I think that we can have an impact in terms of creating metrics, of developing enhanced capabilities in terms of software assurance, and more generally looking at how we can use partnerships to be able to address some of the hindrances that we face today in terms of deployment. And I will point to my last bullet point there, which is changing the playing field. I don't know how to do this, but I really love some of the ideas that people are having in terms of new security architectures that just cast communication in a different light. And yes, those changes are very hard to make from a broad, scalable sense. But from a more controlled, more confined perspective, I really do think that they have the opportunity to have an impact. So thank you very much for your attention. I'll be happy to take some questions at whatever time we have remaining.
Thank you, sir. And for those listening on the phone, if you would like to ask an audio question or make a comment at this time, please press *1 on your touch-tone phone, and please record your name clearly when prompted. Once again, *1, and please record your name clearly when prompted. One moment as we wait for our first questions.
You talked about working with SBIR and so on. ICOR is working with SBIR to have a connection between the programs, so we don't fall off a cliff at that end.
And so I just learned about ICOR today. And I put these slides together last night, so that's why it wasn't reflected. But I think ICOR sounds like a great program, and I'm very enthusiastic about it.
And we do have a question from the phone. Would you like to take the question at this time?
Yes.
It does come from Sava Rajagopalan. Your line is open.
Thank you. Great talk. I'd like to ask the following question. So what we are discovering is that not just the adversary, but the technology we are trying to secure is also moving at an astonishingly rapid pace. So can you point to some specific ideas on new architectures that allows us to leapfrog the technologies that we're trying to secure so we arrive on time rather than, you know, trying to secure yesterday's?
It's a great question. Unfortunately, I can't give you a sort of a list of the top three. Where I think we have the best opportunity are, as I say, opportunities are in the area of software assurance, where we're actually developing software that is provably or testably secure. When we control the entire system, in other words, when we're not trying to extend basic IP infrastructure in some way so that we can detect attacks more precisely, more accurately, in a more timely fashion, but rather when we have an entirely enclosed system that we can control from the top to the bottom of the stack. I can't point to specific projects that are addressing that question, but I know that there are some underway. And I think that self-contained approach, again, that does not lend itself necessarily to broad interactions on the Internet, are ways in which certain verticals or constrained deployments will have the opportunity to be more secure.
Okay, thank you.
And at this time, we have no other questions in the queue.
Please.
I'm curious how much you compared your experience, the growth of it, to other academic schools, and likewise, in particular, Jim Harbaugh from Maryland did a great talk about his experience building a company and selling it to Microsoft. Part of the board.
Sure. So I haven't talked to Bill. But I have certainly talked to others. As I mentioned, Farnam Chahanian was an advisor of mine throughout the process and, you know, obviously a very successful entrepreneur in his own right. I've probably talked to, I don't know, maybe a dozen other people who have had varying levels of success. And there are, you know, many similar themes in terms of some of the issues, challenges, and opportunities that we've encountered. I would say that the single most important element for my modest success was the guidance that I received from my board. I was very, very fortunate to have a board of directors that was composed of alumni from the University of Wisconsin who invested in my company and who were willing to spend the time to take an academic who had never started a company and to really sort of open my eyes to what I needed to pay attention to. And without those people involved in my company, I'm absolutely certain that I would have failed. So that, to me, was the single most important element of my success, and that kind of mentorship, guidance, experienced perspective is a theme that's resonated across all of the other people that I've talked to. Please.
I guess the traditional approach is you create something and then hand it off to entrepreneurs, crossing that boundary and turning academic into advantages of the traditional model include, first of all, the incentives seem to be aligned to keep the efforts. But secondly, a couple of things that you mentioned, you know, when you were in some conversations where you had the unfettered perspective, as you said there, and you know, you were an outsider, a third party that people could trust. I think there are problems when academic fields become too involved on the entrepreneurial side, because at that point you can't entirely trust what they do. So what seems to be happening in medicine, for example, money has played such a big role that it's becoming increasingly certain that, you know, any particular study is telling you the truth or is being. So I'm wondering, you know, what your reaction is to those kinds of defenses of the usual split between the academic and non-academic, and why it is that having academics in
Sure. So a lot of great thoughts in that statement. Let me see if I can tick them off one by one. So first of all, I don't think academics, by and large, make good entrepreneurs. So I think that, and unfortunately, a lot of the infrastructure, especially at universities, is oriented toward trying to make academics entrepreneurs. And the main reason I say it is just that I've been fortunate to be around really, really successful entrepreneurs, and they just bring a different element to the table than most academics that I've been around. I don't know exactly how to articulate it. It's a charismatic element. It's a strategic thinking element. It's a very kind of on the ground, how do I make this happen by hook or by crook kind of an element, as opposed to a staring out the window, hoping the idea will come, and it does. No, I mean, you know, for successful academics, those ideas do come, but it's really a different mindset. It's a different embodiment of sort of success and how you make things happen. So where I really think that the opportunities are in terms of entrepreneurship, as we're trying to state in this activity that we're getting off the ground at University of Wisconsin, is with young people, right? I think youth are highly, highly underestimated in our country, right? Remember, the average age of the person working on the Manhattan Project was 26. Those are young people. Would we ever have, you know, that young an average age in a major project today? Probably not, right? So what I think is embracing youth in terms of creativity, innovation, and entrepreneurship is where we should focus some effort, and that's exactly what this center is about. I totally think that this issue of external corporate funding for research is separate from the idea of entrepreneurship that I talked about. In other words, I think that accepting outside money always comes along with the recognition that you need to, or it should come along with the recognition that you need to be careful about your research, right? Full disclosure, everything needs to be, completely oriented toward, eliminating bias from the work. Otherwise, well, you know what the result is. But what I don't think is that necessarily getting outside money is something that leads to innovation. It's simply another modality for funding research. What I think is we need new modalities for fostering innovation, and I think that the I-Corps program is one. We've got one with our WISC activity, and there are probably others. I think we're done. All right, thank you.